Accession number 8225, rule number 1.
Mr. McCausland, reel 1. Where were you born, Mr. McCausland?
I was born in Glasgow.
Which year was that?
1916.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a ship owner. When I say that, they had 16 small ships which went to the Mediterranean and the West African coast.
And where were you educated?
At Charterhouse.
How old were you when you left?
Well, I have no idea, 18, I suppose.
To do what?
Well, I became articled to a solicitor in Lincoln's Inn Fields. But luckily, the war broke out before I had finished my articles, and I was able to avoid my exams till after the war.
Which unit did you go into?
Well, I first started in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, which I enjoyed very much. And then I was transferred to the Reconnaissance Corps, and I was in the 38th Independent Reconnaissance Squadron for some time. But we were really only training people to be sent abroad, which I didn't enjoy.
Can you tell me what the role of the Reconnaissance Squadron was?
Yes. Well, more of the Reconnaissance Regiment, because this was only a sort of training squadron, really. But in every infantry division had a Reconnaissance Regiment, which consisted of three squadrons, and they were armoured cars and carriers. The theoretical role was that you advanced ahead of the infantry to find out where the Germans were. In other words, the enemy were. You drove along the road until you actually met opposition. When you met it, you normally didn't try to break through, but you found out where the people were. Then you stopped and tried to find a way round. That was one of the roles. Another role was, if you were retreating, you were supposed to keep the enemy off, which was not actually a very practical thing, because you couldn't do that kind of thing in armoured cars. And in a pursuit, you pursued. You would chase a retreating enemy. And I suppose you would also try to cover troops. But for us, it didn't work like that, because we spent most of the time in trenches without our armoured cars. And it was only in the drive up to Rome from Anzio and the last few weeks in Northwest Europe that we were doing our real role at all. When I was with the regiment, I broke my leg just before Sicily, and so I didn't take part in that. And I didn't take part in the drive up the Tour of Italy, which my regiment did. And so they had seen a lot of action before I rejoined them on the Galliano, which was slightly disheartening for me.
And what was your own personal role in the unit?
When I was in the 38th Independent Reconnaissance Squadron, I was a captain, and a telegram came through saying they wanted 12 officers, 12 lieutenants, to go out to North Africa. My squadron commander was away, so I posted myself as one of them because I was bored at home. and that created a lot of fuss and bother, actually. So when I got to the regiment, they said, "We haven't got any room for a captain. You've got to come down to a lieutenant," which obviously I had. And before I joined them in Babylon, there I was a troop commander. But later on, when I rejoined them on the Galliano, I wore spectacles, and so obviously I had to be intelligence officer, which I was. And it was a much nicer job anyway.
What did it involve?
Nothing. Well, in action, the theory is that the intelligence officer dishes out information about the enemy, has an intelligence section, which you send out to find out about the enemy, and in battle, you're the colonel's aide. What I did, actually, was that I have to go to when we were in action. Say, on the first, the Galliano, the squadrons were in trenches at different places. I used to send out two men from the section to each squadron, and I lived at regimental headquarters, and I would visit the squadrons every day because I didn't want to feel that I was sitting in regimental headquarters while people were out there. And so I used to walk out to the squadrons, stay with them for a few hours, walk back in, try to do that to every squadron every day. And also the colonel sent me out on sort of, it was rather fun. I mean, he wanted to see the bombing of the casino, which we knew was going on. So I went up to see that. I liaised with troops on my on our right. Shall I start on the Galliano here?
Yes.
Well, I'll begin at the beginning. I had great difficulty in getting back to the regiment because when you get away from a regiment, there are all sorts of empire-building people who want to give you jobs, and they try to divert you. But I did get back to Italy. And then I got into a transit camp where they kept me doing nothing. So I got in a truck driven by an American Negro, drove north, and eventually got to my regiment. And there was a fuss about that, too, because I was posted as a deserter. But we got over that. And the first sort of action I saw was going, the Battle of the Galliano had just taken place, and the river had been crossed, and my regiment was holding about a mile, or 2 miles, of the, mile and a half of trenches on at the mouth of the river, on the north, the Rome side of it. And when I crossed the river in a truck which the regiment sent for me, shells fell on either side of the river and great spouts came out from the Germans, and I thought this is very exciting. And then I got to the regiment, and when I got there, I was met by a lieutenant whose name I won't give you, and a shell fell about 50 yards from us, and there was a little sort of broken down house thing, and he ran round and round it in circles. So I thought he knew what he was doing, and I ran round and round it in circles too, so I saw the expression on the faces of men watching me. And so I stopped. And it was very interesting. I thought he was sent home next day and nobody said anything to me about it at all.
What was the reason for that?
For what?
For the fact that you were treated differently from him.
I was an unknown factor. They didn't know how I'd behave in the action. His nerve had been going for some time. And so he was just sent away. And they would obviously find out how I was going to behave. I mean, I might not do that again.
Can you look at this period in time? When was it?
So this was in 44. January, was it? I think it must have been January 44. Yes. Yes.
What happened next to you?
Well, we were in these very badly dug trenches, and on our left was the sea. Ahead of us was a flat sort of plain with vines planted onto ridge things like that, and they went in leaf, so you could see quite a long way. And on our right were great big, well, not very big, getting bigger rocky hills, and straight ahead across the flat plain were the Germans in the village, and it's quite a long way away. I'd never been quite sure how far away it was, about 3/4 of a mile, I think. And the first thing that happened to me was the colonel said he wanted me to go and liaise with the guards who were on the 201st Independent Guards Brigade on our right. And it's a lovely sunny day, and I wandered off all by myself, which I shouldn't have done. And then awful crashing sounds starting. And I didn't know what was happening at all. I mean, it was perfectly ludicrous, really, thinking back on it. And so I sat down, and all this crashing went on, and a lot of dust and smoke. So I got up, and I walked on, and I found the guards. I was being mortared, actually. I didn't know it. What I didn't know was the Germans could see you. They were on higher ground, and they could see you, so they mortared me. And there was a jolly guards colonel in the cave who said, "You are a bloody fool," he said. And anyhow, that was got over, and he gave me some tea, and I found out his positions. And I said, "Can I go around the position?" She said, "We go around some of them. You can't go around the forward ones because they're too difficult to get at you. It's not possible." Because they couldn't dig in, and the ground was very open. They were in a very nasty position indeed. And the Germans had called a Nebelwerfer, which is a rocket thrower, which they were busy rocketing the guards with. Very unpleasant indeed. And they were losing a lot of men. But we, because we were reconnaissance corps, were in a much quieter position because they didn't use us ever in a very dangerous position, because which is why I'm alive now, because if you destroyed a man in a car, you destroyed a team, and everyone was trained. Not many people drove cars then, relatively to now, and they trained to work the wireless. Said it was very difficult actually doing the teamwork in a car, being able to use the guns, read the map, work the wireless set, sometimes using Morse, and particularly using code when the enemy were around. And driving it was very difficult in a way too, because you couldn't see very much. So if any of us was killed, then it diminished the efficiency of the regiment a great deal. So we were always given nice easy positions, which we had this time, and at all times.
What happened next?
I can only, how I remember is sort of isolated snapshots of things that affected me at the time. And the thing that affected me quite a lot, actually, because it was my first real sort of do on my own, was about a couple of days after I arrived, the colonel said he'd got maps of the area in front of us with Minen marked on them.
With what?
Minen, mines in German, marked on them. That is, the area between us and the German was mined, according to the maps. And he thought it would be very nice to find out if that was true or not. And so he said, well, you haven't got much to do, John. You better walk over it and see. I thought it was a rather discouraging remark at the time, actually. But and it was left me how I did it. And I took a member of the intelligence squadron called Corporal Robson, who was a very good man indeed. And he got a Tommy gun, and I had a German rifle, which I had liberated. And I decided to go in the daytime, because I was frightened of mines. And I wasn't so frightened of being seen by the Germans and shot at, but I was much more frightened of stepping on a mine, because we knew about them. I mean, the training was very good. I knew what sort of mines there were, what they looked like, and so on. They had shoe mines, which are wooden ones, which they bury.
Shoe mines?
S-C-H-U. And it does mean actually shoe. And they were wooden so that the mine detectors couldn't find them, because they could only react to metal. And the shoe mine is buried a few inches underground, and you tread on it, and it blows your foot off. And they also had another sort of mine, name which I've forgotten, but it's a canister with sort of nails and ball bearings in it. It rose about waist high and then spread out like that. And they had trip wires for that, and that was particularly unpleasant for obvious reasons. And so we set off. I disremembered this because I looked up the war diary, and it actually took me about 3 hours to get there and get back again. So I must have been going very slowly. And I went ahead with Robson about 20 yards behind me. And there was a German sentry on the tower ahead of us, on the sea, actually, sea coast. And he walked around this tower in a circle. And when he looked our way, we lay down, and when he looked the other way, we went on. This all sounds rather incredible when I think about it now, but at the time, I was feeling extremely tense, but not a bit frightened. I was too inexperienced to be frightened. I'd have felt very differently later on. And we went on, and by sort of stopping and starting and stopping and starting, we got to the houses in the village. I was a bit frightened before the houses, just before them, because I thought, well, they're hiding there, and they're going to shoot me when I get there. But they didn't, and I don't know what they were doing. The German regiment had been very bad, division had been very badly knocked about in the crossing of Galliano, and it wasn't at all a good one. And they were not. We fought against good troops later, and these people were no good at all. Anyhow, I got into the village, and the moment I got there, and again, this seemed unbelievable, were about half a dozen big, fat Italian women in black robes, because they all were peasants, wore these black robe things in, rushed out, and they threw their arms around us, and they shouted at the tops of their voices, for very inglese, Tedeschi, Tedeschi. I mean, poor English, the Germans here, which I knew. And I thought if it kept quiet, it'd be very much better. Anyway, they were awfully friendly and nice, but very noisy. So I thought the best thing to do was to go into a house. And I told Robson to stay at the door and guard it, and I would go upstairs and look out of the window. He didn't actually. He came in because he didn't like standing by himself, and he came upstairs with me. And when we got up to the first floor, I saw a German officer about, a very short distance away from me. I mean, I could have thrown a stone and hit him. He's a great fat man. I can remember vividly now, with his jacket unbuttoned, jacket collar unbuttoned, his hands behind his back, and he was pacing up and down. And there were several German soldiers lying on the ground, because it was quite pleasant weather then, and a great big gun with a camouflage net over it. And I remember just if it's yesterday, and I said to Robson, I'll shoot him. And Robson said, no, don't. You will never get back if you do. Which was sensible, because we were not on a fighting patrol. The distinction between the fighting patrols, you go out, fighting patrol and reconnaissance patrol. A fighting patrol, you go to actually kill somebody. A reconnaissance patrol, you go out to find out something, which is what I was doing. I was sent to find out if there were any mines between it, us and the Germans. And so I didn't, and we came back. And I didn't like coming back very much, because, I mean, I knew we were visible both from the village and from the heights on the inland. And it's funny, it's ridiculous really, but it seemed much more dangerous with your back to them than going towards them. It wasn't, of course. Anyway, we did get back quite safely. And then we shelled the village, which distressed me, because I wondered what happened to the Italian women who were there.
What was the upshot of your report?
And the report, I said I didn't see any mines at all, and I reported the whereabouts of the gun, and I said I thought the village was badly guarded. And we discovered later that, in fact, they didn't bother much in the daytime, because they could see us, they thought, crossing, and they could have seen many people. And they sent standing patrols out at night forward of the village to hold it. Because we sent, later on, we sent patrols out at night, and we always met the Germans at night. But in the daytime, they just sort of didn't have to bother. Particularly because if any big attack, worthwhile attack, came across the plain, they would have seen it from the heights inland, and they could have stopped it by artillery fire dead. So they really didn't have very much to bother about. And if we had sent in a patrol which had done any damage, they'd never have got back.
What happened next?
Nothing really. One just stayed there, and people went out on patrol, and there was shelling. It was slightly tense. I mean, there wasn't. You were shelled every day, but it wasn't very serious shelling. We weren't shelled by the naval warfare. We were terrified that we would be. It was chiefly 88mm guns and some slightly heavier guns, but nothing very much. But it did add up to a sort of tenseness. Just before we went, a very funny thing happened, actually. At night, halfway between us and the Germans, we saw a light. And there were no lights. I mean, there's nobody moving about. So this is kind of one thing the colonel sent me to do. See, he said, you better go and find out what that is. So I went out to see. And there, at a sort of crossroads, was a military policeman. And he was putting up lights, you know, these little paraffin lights they had, all over the place. And I said, you can't do this, you'll be killed. And he said, no, sir, he said, I've been ordered to go here. There's going to be an advance over this area. And I have to guide them. And actually, he misread his map. He's in a totally wrong place. But it took me about 10 minutes to get the chap to come back again.
What happened next?
Well, then we were relieved by, I think it was the 88th Texan Division, who took over the whole of the divisional area, and we were left to see them in. And they were bloody awful. I can say this because they did become a fine division later on. But it was very interesting. They arrived, and they were all very tensed up. They'd never been in action before. And I having had 3 weeks or a month's action, felt very experienced. And I remember their brigadier coming down, actually citing individual platoon positions and things, which I thought was very odd. And another lieutenant, captain, stood on a little hillock in full view of the Germans. And I said to him, I don't think that's wise. And I was taken away by his lieutenant, who said, the captain is very, very experienced. And I said, what has he done? He's had 6 weeks of fought something or other. And the first chaps I showed in were, they were put in a position in a house, a destroyed house. Actually, this is a place called Castle 40, slightly further on.
Called what?
Castle 40. But it was in our area. It was a little, we did that too. And there's a very nice Texan major who came up, and let's see how they're getting on. And when we got there, the American platoon was nowhere to be seen, not at all. And eventually we found them in the cellar because a shell had fallen about 100 yards away from them. And he said, I think I'd better deal with this. And I went away. But when I say all that, they were very good later on. It was only an experience. All troops are bad in the beginning. So there isn't a real criticism of them. After that, we went up to the mountains, a place called Kasoli was the sort of base. Or I don't know how to pronounce it actually, C-A-S-O-L-I. And it's near the Adriatic coast, northeast of Cassino. And it was very, very snowy, very difficult to move around at all. You couldn't do it. It was a nice war there, actually. For me, it was the best part of the war. Because there it was in the winter, the weather was sunny and beautiful. There was no shelling. There were raids, and there was a lot of patrolling. But you couldn't get very far. One of our patrols, there was a pass in the mountains, and through it, escaped prisoners of war and people used to come. One of our patrols went up there, and they stopped when the snow got about 4 feet deep and they couldn't get any further. And they found a bus ticket from Florence and a French letter in the snow. I remember this. But no Germans. Actually, when we were there, and it was only for 2 or 3 weeks, I think only about half a dozen of our men were killed, and that was all. I mean, it was nothing at all. So it was very pleasant.
What condition were the escaping POWs in?
Oh, yes, it was very odd when they came in. We lived in comfort. Regimental headquarters lived in comfort. I mean, on the Galliano, I lived in a disused pigsty, and it was wet and it was rather cold and rather nasty, but we had a house there, and we used to take them into the mess, and they would sit and such snobby, they'd look round like this. They were very, very, very nervous, but they'd all been befriended by the Italians, and they were full of praise for the way the Italians looked after them. But they were quite well fed, they were quite fit, but they were extremely nervous. I was astonished. Really, virtually nothing happened there. An interesting thing, I'm going back in time, was I went out with 12 officers, and it's quite interesting to see what happened as a sort of epitome of the war for us. Well, 13 of us, 12 officers and me. One of them left us at Basra because he got a better job. We were all offered jobs at Basra by an Empire Building brigadier. I was offered the job of anti-gas officer in Northwest Persia. And out of the 13 of us, only one accepted, which was pleasant. He left us. Three didn't stand up to action in Sicily and were sent home. One was thought to be too stupid and was transferred to the infantry, and one military cross, so he did better than any of us. Three were killed, two were wounded, and that leaves, I don't know how many, two or three. So it was an interesting sort of thing to see what your chances were and what happened.
What's an empire-building brigadier?
Anybody who has an organization likes to increase it. Whether it's in business, the Imperial War Museum, or what have you, they like to make it bigger and bigger, and they try to recruit people to it because it increases their importance.
An empire builder.
Yeah.
Now, you broke off the narrative at Kasoli.
Yes.
Anything else of note happen there?
No. A friend of mine, Ian McCondack, got killed there.
Ian?
McCondack. McCondack. Ian McCondack killed there. He was a lieutenant, he's very good, but I don't think much of interest or importance.
What happened to you after Kasoli?
We were told we were going on leave to Vico Equense, which is in the Sorrento Peninsula, and we drove down there, and we had two wonderful days. I mean, it was the first time out of action for quite a long time, and certainly a very long time for the regiment. And then we were told we were going up to Anzio, which we didn't like very much. Anzio was this unopposed landing south of Rome. It happened, I think, on January 22nd. And they could have driven into Rome. I met a guards lieutenant who said he landed on his jeep that day and he could have driven into Rome quite easily. But whether it was right to do so or not, I don't know. They were very, very fiercely attacked by the Germans and very nearly driven into the sea, and it was a very close thing. I think General Westphal, who was head of the German staff there, said they had more resources at their disposal, the Germans more resources than any battle since Sebastopol. So they were really trying very hard.
Sebastopol?
Yes. They... When we were told we were going to Anzio, we went to a place called Nocera, which was on the way, because we had to embark from Pozzuoli, which is the port of Naples. And then Vesuvius blew its top, which was great fun, actually. It was the biggest eruption it had had since 17... whatever it was, the big one they had in 1770, or whatever it was. And it was really rather frightening. You never knew when it was going to stop. And we had to get away, and we got in our cars and we drove away, pushing, I'm afraid, Italian civilians into the ditch, which was not pleasant.
How did they react?
Oh, they couldn't do anything. I mean, the women sat and wept, and the men looked helpless. I mean, there it was, we pushed their carts in. Because we had to get on, we had to go, and we didn't want to do it, but you've got to do that.
Was there any cursing or abuse?
No, none at all, no. Then, when we got to Pozzuoli, I went up, the regiment stayed behind, and I went up with the colonel to Anzio, head of the regiment, to sort of see what was going on as intelligence officer there. We landed at this port, which was pretty well knocked down. And I was really frightened, actually, because Anzio was really a dread word, and my teeth hurt like anything. And that was entirely because I was frightened. And they stopped hurting a couple of days later.
Because of clenching your teeth, you mean?
No, your teeth do hurt, actually, if you're very frightened sometimes. And they did. But I didn't realise at the time that was so. I talked to our doctor about it later, and he said, yes, that was it. And then we went up. I and the colonel went up, and we were met by a brigadier. I talk about brigadiers because those are the senior officers one ever met, really. It was his job to show us our positions and so on. And he really shook me. He was grey and he was twitching. And he kept on saying, I think we can hold on, I'm sure we can hold on. Which is not... Our brigadiers in my division were very good. One, Lorne Campbell, had the VC and two DSOs. And the others were equally good. And I wasn't used to that sort of behaviour. Because it's the job of an officer to be light-hearted and encouraging and so on. This chap wasn't at all. We arrived in a dugout, and it was just like pictures of the First World War. It's a biggish dugout underground with timber roof, and paraffin lamps, and people poring over maps. And we were given our orders. And I remember when we went out of the dugout, somebody said, don't go that way, there's usually a stonk on that area. And the colonel said to me, John, what's a stonk? And I said, I don't know, sir. And he said, you don't know? And I said, no. I said, what is it, sir? He said, I don't know either. And actually, the song is a concentration of artillery. But we found out where the regiment was going, and one of my jobs was to show one of the squadrons into their positions. And this is an occasion that really did frighten me. They were marching along to their positions in threes as one march then. And